The next case is 00448 Webster Lonis versus Himmel E. Kale.
May I please report, my name is Steve Tamakis.
Mr. Tamakis.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time on mine.
Yes.
Thank you. Your Honors, I'm here on an issue. I guess I could be accused of being myopic about it. It seems to me that it's fairly black and white. Our Ohio Constitution provides that the common police courts of this state have jurisdiction, original jurisdiction over all contract matters, breach of contract matters. Suddenly, the Industrial Commission devises an administrative code provision saying that in the workers' compensation setting, the Industrial Commission has exclusive jurisdiction to determine all fee disputes. Obviously, those two ideas are at loggerheads. We're in a situation where essentially the Industrial Commission, by virtue of the administrative code provision, has wrested away from the common police courts that jurisdiction. It seems to me that the interpretation that was put on the administrative code provision by the Court of Appeals, by the majority, is wrong.
Why would you say it's significantly different than other things we commit to an administrative agency? I mean, the extent of disability, for instance. Why do you feel that that wasn't likewise wrested from courts?
Justice Cook, if I understand your question, I think it's because we have an Ohio constitutional provision that says that the courts have jurisdiction in this particular instance versus others.
This was an argument that wasn't made at the trial court, as
Your Honor,
I understand it.
It may have been brought up, but certainly I prevailed at the trial court. This case was resolved in a 10-page opinion, ironically, on summary judgment by the trial court. And certainly wasn't, I believe that my opposing counsel may have raised the idea of whether this issue shouldn't be determinative. In other words, whether the Industrial Commission's hearing on this ended everything. But I prevailed, and that's the interesting thing is that I prevailed. It wasn't until we got to the Court of Appeals that it actually became an issue.
Well, it's an issue, though. I mean, from the beginning, you're arguing the proper jurisdiction. That essentially, no, you
yeah,
wouldn't be on.
And the reason I say that, Justice Cook, is because, and it's interesting, we actually won at the Industrial Commission level. We prevailed. The hearing that we had before the commission.
I'm aware of that. They set a fee at 10-7.
No. What the commission said, and I think if you read the opinion, you can ascertained that Mr. Stavridis, the hearing officer, understood that that decision was an advisory opinion. Because what he said to us is that I believe that 10-7 is a fair settlement figure at the very end. I think that clearly he understood that his decision was not going to be binding. I mean, frankly, there's no appeal from that decision. How do I enforce that decision? There's no ability for me to do that. But we did prevail, and when we got to the trial court, our claim didn't have anything to do with what occurred at that level. It was
you voluntarily submitted your fee dispute to the tribunal, and you had the right under the statute to reduce it to a judgment at the Court of Appeals or at the common pleas level to collect. So you did have a remedy, and you didn't. And your client didn't voluntarily. Statute gives you the right to once the dispute is decided by the Industrial Commission, gives you the right to go to the court to use it to judgment for collection, does it not?
No. Just Stratton, at the outset, I need to tell you that the premise that we submitted ourselves to the Industrial Commission is wrong. I read that in the brief memo that was provided to us outside. That's wrong. What happened, and it's interesting to me, if you look at what that administrative code provision says, either party may ask for that hearing. Either party. And indeed, it was the appellee that asked for that hearing.
And if you didn't think they had jurisdiction, then why did you raise the constitutional argument then?
Your Honor,
you simply went forward with the hearing and got your judgment. Now, you interpret it differently than the other people interpret it, but you got a judgment of some sort.
No, Your Honor. The decision from the Industrial Commission isn't even an order. It's actually a letter at the outset. But more importantly, we didn't get a judgment. I mean,
wouldn't it have been futile for you to raise the constitutional issue?
I think I was going to make that point as well. The Industrial Commission doesn't really have the authority to pass on the constitutionality of that particular statute or not.
Well, particularly when you were taken there, you didn't go. You were taken there. But I understand your argument about the court. I understand your argument about the dispute and the contract. So I'm not missing that just because my question is going to seem not relevant maybe to that. And for purposes of argument, I agree with you and I want to buy that argument. Did your client sign a release? When I read in appendix page 51, it seems to me that that's a release for the $5,000.
Your Honor, I believe that it is. I believe that it is a release.
It's a release of all claims. It's not artfully done.
Your Honor, I have to agree with you. I think that, and I don't want to assume that that's your position. Yeah, I have to agree with you that it is a release. But the undercurrent of this whole thing, and if I might, first of all, the Court of Appeals never resolved this issue. Of course, they skipped over that to determine that there wasn't any jurisdiction. What transpired, bear with me for just a minute, was that the parties were engaged in negotiation about this whole thing. I don't think that my clients really wanted to go through and have a lawsuit filed over this and pursue this gentleman at all. I mean, life is too short. But they tried to negotiate a resolution, and they thought they had. Mr. Kale decided that they hadn't resolved the issues and elected to go forward with this fee dispute hearing anyway. That was part and parcel to the
That was after the release?
Oh, yes.
After
oh, yes.
the release?
Oh, yes.
Did he pay the $5,000 for the release?
Yes, he did, prior. Yes.
All right. So your client got the first part of the fee, then got $5,700 from the commission.
That's right.
And $5,000 here.
No.
How does it come out that $15,000 is still owed?
What had happened, Your Honor, was the bill came in to Mr. Kale, and Mr. Kale sent my clients a check for $5,000. Mm-hmm. And he said, basically, this is all I'm paying you. I don't believe you're entitled to anymore.
That was initially.
The my clients and Mr. Kale had signed a document that allows them to get the $5,700 in advance payments.
Okay.
Prior to receiving Mr. Kale's $5,000 check, prior to being put on notice that he wasn't going to pay him anymore, they submitted that document to the Industrial Commission and said, you know, this is for the future benefits. Well, the Industrial Commission sent the check. In the meantime,
not the check, a different check, $5,700.
Exactly, the different check, you're right. In the meantime, both parties are negotiating. And my client is over here saying, okay, we'll take what we've received, and that'll be the end of it. And Mr. Kale is over here saying, okay, I can deal with that, that's fine by me. Mr. Kale is under the understanding that all my clients had received was $5,000. Whereas my clients were under the understanding that he knew about the $5,000 because the Industrial Commission notifies the clients,
okay.
And that he knew about the other $5,700.
Let's get to the settlement.
So there wasn't any meeting of the minds.
You were negotiating some settlement.
Indeed.
All right. So he got $5,000 to start with, $5,700 from the commission.
Right.
And then this release. Didn't he pay $5,000 at the time of this release to settle the full claim?
No. That was the original.
You're saying that this release involves the original 5,000.
Yes, sir.
Did that not release him of all claims, the client?
Well, ultimately, I don't think so because of the lack of the meeting of minds. The parties just never came to an agreement as to what was out there in terms of what money we were talking about.
Okay, but this is your client's signature on the release.
Oh, without a doubt, Your Honor.
Okay.
Without a doubt.
But it was he thought he was releasing it for $5,000, your client, at the time originally.
Yeah.
A $20,000 obligation.
Indeed.
And then you got $5,700 more from the commission.
Indeed.
And now, the trial court gives you a $15,000 judgment vis-a-vis the $20,000 being $15,000 or 20 less 5 is 15.
Right. And the trial court found that the parties did not come to a meeting of the minds. That's what the trial court found. And ultimately,
and skipped over the release.
No, sir. He was very aware of the release, Your Honor. Very aware.
The trial court?
He read the transcripts. And like I said, interestingly enough, he wrote a 10-page decision in this particular matter. He went through every document painstakingly, and he came to the conclusion that even though a release was present, the parties never came to a meeting as to really what they were releasing, ultimately.
Well, your clients, of course, are the ones who brought the action for further fees. So you would not have wanted that release to have any force or effect. It would have been a mutual release. And you weren't, obviously, you were seeking additional fees.
Your Honor, it was my client's position that, and I'm going to read things into the record that probably aren't there.
That's okay. I just note that you were your client that was bringing the action for the additional fees after the release.
Your Honor, my clients issued a release, no two ways about it, but the understanding was that the parties would, forgive me, would go and sin no more. I mean, everybody's going to go your own separate way, we're going to accept this. Then comes this hearing, the one that we're here about. And my clients are saying, well, wait a minute, we had a release. You know, we were going to agree to release all claims. And now suddenly you're violating a fee dispute.
Well, in the meantime, there was another $5,000 paid that wasn't part of that. Move on.
Your client thought they were selling for $10,700, correct?
Because
they knew they had that payment.
Your Honor, it's easier in my mind, at least, and maybe it'd be easier for me to convey to you. If you look at it from the standpoint of what two payments, there was a $20,000 bill that was submitted for doing accrued benefits, no two ways about it. The $5,000, the $5,700, was for future benefits. So certainly my clients were releasing as to the $5,000 on the 20th.
But you're not allowed to charge for future benefits.
Well, and yes, you are. That's why that document is submitted to the Industrial Commission, and it's actually a form, and I wish, of all days, I could
agree. But regardless, your client thought he was getting $10,000.
That's true.
And Hailford is getting $5,000.
Yes, ma'am.
So it seems to me that you got what you thought you bargained for. Your client has $10,000 right now.
Your Honor, the agreement was that if the parties would just end the litigation.
What did your client get?
$10,700.
Your client got $10,700, which is what they thought they were agreeing to, back in the release, and they still want more.
Your Honor.
By all your expectations, if you want to go and sit no more, you got $10,700, and you want more.
Your Honor, my client wanted what the fee contract.
Why don't you make the distinction? It's two different actions. One is for the accrued benefits and one is for the future benefits. They're two different actions. $57,000 was for the future. The $20,000 is for the accrued benefits. They're two different things. So you didn't get $10,700 on the You didn't get $10,700 on the accrued benefits award.
Mr. Tamakis, let me ask you all of this discussion makes me conclude or want to ask the question, is a decision in this case based upon contract law or upon your proposition of law that your proposition of law is a good proposition. I mean, it seems to me it's, you know, we have to decide which forum is the correct forum to resolve this. Are the facts in this case so unique that we can write a rule of law on them, do you think?
Oh, Your Honor, I think so. I hope you do. We have essentially three jurisdictions going in three different ways. From the standpoint of that Kahan case that I cited, I think all of us in the practice have always thought, well, this is the precursor to filing a lawsuit. And now, suddenly, it's a situation where we're not really sure because we have the Falk versus Watts case come out that says, no, you know, that's not binding. So, it is a unique situation, Ron. It really is.
Thank you, Mr. Tamakis. Mr. Renner.
My name is Richard Renner. I'm an attorney with a general practice in Dover, Ohio. And with me is Assistant Attorney General Cheryl Nestor on behalf of the State of Ohio and the Industrial Commission, and also Emma Kale, the widow of my original client, Wilbur Kale. It is an honor for me to represent Wilbur Kale's interests here.
Counsel, does the Industrial Commission have a policy that contingent fee contracts for this kind of work are against public policy and should not be countenanced?
The statute here gives to the Industrial Commission the duty to determine what fee is just and reasonable based on the facts and circumstances of each case. They are, of course...
No, I don't read the statute as quite going that far.
It says that you
protect parties against unfair fees.
Right. And that means they have a duty to determine what fee is fair in each particular case. And certainly, the existence of a contingency contract in the
bank. You turn a protection against unfair fees into a duty to set up a whole fee schedule, I think.
Not to set up a fee schedule, but to look at the facts and circumstances of each case and fashion a determination about what fee will be fair to the attorney and protect the claimant.
So is that the way the practice works now? Is every fee, regardless of a contingent fee contract, is now determined by the commission?
Only if there's a dispute. Now, in my practice, I try to demonstrate to my clients that I am committed to their interests, and I put their interests ahead of mine. And so far, I've been successful at avoiding these types of fee disputes with my clients. But where those disputes exist, it is my duty as an attorney to cheerfully submit to lawful government determination of whether or not my relationship with my client is fair, because I share with the government an interest in protecting my client and the public as a whole from fees that are either illegal or clearly excessive. That is part of the deal. That is why my contract with my clients is different than ordinary contract relationships.
So when you have a fee dispute, the contract with the client is abrogated at that point.
I'm saying that contracts between attorneys and clients are different because of the fiduciary duty. I have a duty with my clients to uphold their interests, even though I might suffer as a result.
And that would be true in any other contingent fee contract outside the workers' comp arena as well.
Certainly that professional duty applies, and I do believe that attorneys who practice with contingent fee agreements, which I myself do in some circumstances, need to be sensitive to the fact that in some circumstances a huge fee results for very little work, and the fee is unjust, and that the attorney has a duty to look retrospectively to adjust the fee to be reasonable.
A small fee when under a contingent fee contract, or no fee at all, or an enormous work is expended is unjust as well. And
I've been there too.
And the attorney should then be able to step outside the contract and sue the client for reasonable value of the services performed?
Well, the reason why these lines are drawn is not for the benefit of the attorney.
All right. I think I have a specific question.
I like to think that in some circumstances, the client might look back at my services and realize that the fee we originally agreed on was not fair for what I undertook on behalf of that client. But I would not have a right to sue to obtain more than what I contracted for. That would be a matter of adjustment at the discretion of the client after the representation is completed. And likewise, after the representation is completed, I, as an attorney, have a duty to look back to see if the fee I charge was fair and reasonable to that client, because I have a fiduciary duty to that client, because my relationship...
I guess what I'm going with this is if the Bureau feels that it has some affirmative duty under this statute, then shouldn't it put out a set of rules that says either you can't use contingent fee contracts in this practice, or if you do, the fee cannot exceed X. Isn't that what the statute called for instead of having
perhaps my calling
a better case by case looking at, well, gee, this one was easy, so even though you had a contingent fee contract, which we allow in this practice, in this case, your client got a big hit and you got an easy fee and you only had to fill out a few forms, didn't even have to go visit to the offices. Your secretary took it over and the lawyer's time was a few hours. So on this one, we're going to set aside the contract.
Or modify it.
That hardly seems right.
Well, I would look forward to the day when attorneys understanding this obligation would write into their fee agreements with their clients that the fee provided by this contract may be modified for the protection of the client by the Industrial Commission. Here is the address where you write if you have a dispute, and I tell you as your attorney that I will abide by the decision of the Industrial Commission, and its decision will be part of this contract. That would truly protect clients from illegal fees. Fees in excess of what the Industrial Commission allows. But I think it's perfectly appropriate, and it's important that the Industrial Commission, which has the duty of providing financial security to injured workers, to make sure that the money it provides goes for that purpose, and that the attorneys who practice before it submit themselves to accomplish that goal.
Let me make sure I understand your argument exactly. You're saying, let's just use the round figures, $20,000 fee for $60,000 recovery is too much in this case.
Yes, I'm here to tell you that.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So regardless of any contracts or commission or anybody, you billed me $20,000 on a $60,000 recovery, and you're saying that's too much.
I'm not saying that it would be too much in every case.
I'm saying in this case. In this case.
But in this case. It was a 45-minute hearing that required no additional evidence.
I understand all that. Your position is, in this case, $20,000 is too much.
Right.
And so, therefore, I'm not bound by the contract. My client am not bound by the contract.
That is not the reason why my client was not bound to the contract.
Now, that goes to the second step.
The reason is to what Justice Lundberg Stratton raised earlier, which is that this matter was submitted for determination by the Industrial Commission.
That's the second step. The first step is denial of the $20,000 bill, payment of the $20,000 bill. I'm not paying that. So you're upset, so you go to the Industrial Commission.
That's what my client did.
Okay. Now the sequence of events is that was a dispute between the parties over the $20,000. Did they discuss settlement?
Oh yes, we have the release.
Well, that's where I'm going, counsel.
Right.
Now, at that point, they end up saying, okay, we'll settle for $5,000. Is that what the attorney said? I know you have to understand that page 51 of the appendix, the release is, at best, not very artfully drawn.
My client did it pro se before.
But it was fine. I mean, they paid the $5,000 to the attorneys.
Yes.
Did your client at that point think that that settled that compromise and settled the $20,000 obligation?
He believed he had settlement for $5,000.
Okay. Then why did he go to the commission?
Because afterwards, he learned that his weekly benefits were being reduced by $37.25 a week for the rest of his life to give the attorneys an additional $5,700.
For additional award for additional case, if you will. And all arising out of the same claim number, but it was, one was for accrued benefits and one was for future benefits, wasn't it?
My client didn't see that distinction. Do you thought attorneys had agreed to
make I'm asking you, isn't that distinction there, however? We've got to straighten out not what they thought, not what your client thought, but what we have in front of us. In fact, they knew, he knew that they had billed him $20,000, that he had paid $5,000, he then found out they got $5,700, so he appealed the $20,000 fee to the commission.
Actually, he had done that before paying the $5,000, but he proceeded with the hearing.
Okay, was the appeal to the commission before the compromise and settlement?
After the compromise and settlement.
You just said before. Now, which is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. The appeal was before the compromise and settlement, but the hearing was after.
Okay, so he got the $20,000 bill. He didn't like the $20,000 bill, so he went to the commission.
That's right.
And that case allegedly was settled for
$5,000. Right.
Everybody went away.
And then my client got the notice about
of the
$5,700.
Of the $5,700.
Right.
So at that point then,
he proceeded with the hearing.
He goes back and says, I want a hearing because now... But he'd already compromised the $20,000, so that wasn't an issue anymore, was it?
And that was a matter of the merits that the Industrial Commission considered and decided. In essence, my client lost. He went to the Industrial Commission because he felt that the attorneys taking the $5,700 in the advance lump sum was unfair on top of the settlement for the $5,000.
So my point is, and my question is, that issue wasn't even jurisdictionally proper before the commission.
Oh, I disagree. Let me
find out why you disagree. They had a dispute. He goes to the commission. They enter into a settlement agreement. Doesn't that end it before the commission?
Well, the enforcement of that settlement...
Doesn't every other court a compromise and settlement and a release?
I could present some examples where judges look at those agreements and find that either the matter was not properly settled, but they're not yet before this court here today. And in this case, the issue my client presented to the Industrial Commission is that he thought he had a settlement for $5,000, and he asked the Industrial Commission to enforce that settlement agreement on those terms. And he lost. The Industrial Commission found that $10,700 was fair and reasonable for the service rendered.
Counsel, when did the client file a grievance?
I'm sorry, I don't have that answer.
I did that before or after this assessment. This letter of settlement.
It was after. I think it might have been after he redeemed his stuff. Because I think he made that grievance part of the lawsuit in which he was contending the attorneys who were seeking to recover a fee that was beyond the amount lawfully debited. Namely, the amount determined by the district. Let me just point out to raise the waiver issue.
Let me, before you do that, I'm still concerned about the law in the case,
yes.
Which law we apply. I hate to be nettlesome about this, but that is what we're here to do. Is your strongest argument on the law that the Industrial Commission has the exclusive jurisdiction? Is it 412306, which seems
yes.
to be the Industrial Commission?
That is the statute through which the General Assembly designated the Industrial Commission to resolve those disputes.
So this case is somewhat complicated by the facts. I mean, usually I guess it'd be a pretty easy set of facts that we'd be presented. What about this case doesn't take us out of the... Well, why isn't this case taken out of the Industrial Commission because of the unique facts here, the sort of contract law that's applied?
Frankly, I don't see unique facts here that affect the jurisdiction of the Industrial Commission. This is a contract dealing with the fees in a workers' compensation matter. Therefore, 41, 43.06 designates the Industrial Commission as having the exclusive jurisdiction to determine that dispute. And the Industrial Commission has a proper function here to make sure the benefits it provides to claimants is used to benefit injured claimants and is not unduly over-proportioned toward the attorneys who represented them. They have a duty to look out for the claimants for their benefit. It is both a constitutional duty of the Industrial Commission and a statutory duty. And to counteract the first argument that was made by my opposite number, this was not a sudden grab for power by the Industrial Commission. The statute was adopted by the General Assembly in 1953. In 1961, this court in Adams versus Fleck held that it was an exclusive grant of jurisdiction, requiring attorneys to go there to obtain a determination before they go to the courts to enforce a claim for fees and workers' compensation matters. And only thereafter did the Industrial Commission, as a helpful aid to the parties practicing before it, explain the established law on this exclusive jurisdiction in their regulation. It was not the regulation that established that exclusive jurisdiction, but rather the General Assembly through its statute as interpreted by this court, the Adams versus Fleck. And as to the constitutional issue, I have here a copy of the November 6, 1996 memorandum by plaintiff's counsel in opposition to our motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction in the trial court. The argument is 3 pages long and includes no mention of the constitutional claim they have raised in their proposition of law. Similarly, after this matter had been fully litigated with the jurisdictional issue presented by us to the trial court, and then appealed with our first assignment of error based on this jurisdictional issue, the brief of appellees before the Court of Appeals again contains in their table of authorities no citation to any constitutional provision. Similarly, after we have raised the statutory jurisdictional issue, there was no effort to bring in the Attorney General's office as a party to defend the constitutionality of that statute.
Thank you, Mr. Renner. Mr. Tamakis, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to make 3 points. At the outset, I think that what I said in my brief is absolutely correct. The Industrial Commission is almost acting like a super judiciary in this particular situation. They are not bound by the rules of evidence, yet they're asked at this point in time to interpret the contract and determine whether it's fair or not fair. The problem here is, and the most interesting thing is, and we're talking about these, three courts, three jurisdictions have all said that the fee charged here was fine. The disciplinary council said it was not clearly excessive. The Industrial Commission here did not criticize this one-third fee contract, and the trial court said it was fine.
I'm still troubled by looking at the facts of this particular case. Your client shouldn't be stopped from making any further claim fees after accepting the $5,057.
You're asking me more from the standpoint of the release versus what transpired in the industrial commission.
Right.
And again, I would tend to agree with you, and I think they wanted to be released from this whole thing, but clearly, appellant, I believe, did not. Clearly, he acted contrary to what
I can understand your client is upset after being having a complaint filed with disciplinary counsel and all of that.
Your Honor, the disciplinary counsel's decision was in October. This complaint was filed in September. It wasn't a matter of malice, and it wasn't a matter of vengeance. It was a situation where the parties had thought they had resolved this issue, and clearly the appellee carried on contrary. And that's interesting, too. How do you enforce a release with the Industrial Commission? How do you do that? I mean, you show the Industrial Commission this release, they don't have to abide by it. They're not bound by the rules of evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Tamakis.
I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.